This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Like every other day, Sherry Fiakoyo woke up at 4 a.m. She wrapped herself in the colorful headscarf common to Muslim women in northern Ghana and set off to search for water. As she walked under the pre-dawn sky, chain lightning jumped between clouds that have so far refused to release any rain. The young woman returned to the family compound of huts surrounding a common courtyard and cooked breakfast for her husband and children. She saw the oldest kids off to school, strapped her baby to her back, and helped her husband weed their fields of millet and maize before preparing lunch. And then, Sherry got to work.
Rice, that's my business. I buy raw rice, parboil it, dry it, and grind off the husks. People buy it because it takes less time to cook, and that means less time finding fuel wood. There aren't too many women selling it, so it's a good business to be in.
Sherry lives in a corner of rural Africa that is rich in culture and tradition, but poor economically. 7 out of 10 people here meet the World Bank definition of poverty. Most citizens in Senergo village scratch out a subsistence living in soil that can be scorched or sodden, depending on the time of year. If the harvest is healthy, some of the crops can be sold on the open market, although yields are usually just enough to feed the family. But because of her small business, Sherry earns the money she needs to pay for her children's education.
I now have the opportunity to pay for my children's school fees and for school uniforms. The business also lets me contribute to the family by buying food or fuel. I can help solve problems in the household, like feeding, clothing, and if someone is sick.
Sherry owns no land and has few belongings. She lives in a compound of round huts made with bricks of mud and straw. Illiterate and with no collateral, she couldn't just walk into a bank and fill out a loan application, even if she only needed a few dollars to kickstart her business. Banks are for people with money. So Sherry and 9 other women in her village formed a lending circle and received a small collateral-free loan from Amasashina. It's a community development group whose name means common people. That first loan was worth about $100 and was divided into 10 microloans, one for each woman to start a micro-business. Sherry used her share to buy a first batch of raw rice.
It is a group loan, but we each have our own business. Some women sell rice, some produce shea butter, and some sell different products in the market. We select women who we know can make a business work. We pick 10 women for the group, women we know in the village.
Sherry is participating in a scheme known as microcredit. It's a way to offer the poor a hand up, not a handout. Sam Daly Harris is the director of the Global Microcredit Summit campaign and founder of Results International, a citizens group that lobbies on hunger and poverty issues. I met up with him while he was in Halifax, Nova Scotia, preparing for the latest microcredit summit. He explains the thinking behind the concept.
Well, basically, it's providing small loans, often to poor and very poor people, without collateral, so that they can either start or expand a tiny business with that working capital, with that loan. It's a revolution in banking. In other words, when banks would only lend to the rich, microloans go to the poor. When banks lend to men, they're predominantly lent to women. When banks made large loans, these are small loans. When banks require collateral, these loans are collateral free. When banks require paperwork with your loan, these loans are illiterate friendly. When you have to go to the bank, These microbanks usually go to the village. So it's really a revolution in banking, breaking rule after rule to even exist.
What we today call microcredit was popularized in 1976 when economist and Nobel Peace Prize winner Muhammad Yunus created the Grameen Bank.
I love the story of how Grameen Bank started, where Muhammad Yunus came to the U.S. to get a Ph.D. in economics at Vanderbilt and eventually returned home to teach at Chittagong University in Bangladesh. And there was a famine in Bangladesh at the time. And he said, the economic theories in my textbook are very elegant, but they're not working in the village next to my campus. I'm going to go in the village and learn economics from the villagers. He met a woman who was making bamboo stools for sitting on. He asked her how much money profit she made every day. She said, I make 2 pennies a day profit. He said, well, how is that possible? It's a beautiful stool. Why do you only make 2 pennies profit? She said, well, I don't have the money to buy the bamboo, so I borrow the money from a trader, a money lender, on the condition that I sell the finished product back to him at a price he sets. And the price he sets barely covers the cost of the raw materials. And he said, well, if you could sell it to anyone, could you make more than that? And she said, I could, but I don't have the money to buy the bamboo, so I have to keep going back to this trader. And so Professor Yunus had a student go around the village to find out who else borrows from this money lender. And the student found 42 people who needed a grand total of $27. And so Professor Yunus lent 42 people a grand total of $27 from his pocket. And this woman immediately went from 2 pennies a day profit to $1.25 a day profit, because now she could sell her stool to the highest bidder. And these 42 became the first borrowers of what became Grameen Bank, which has 6 million borrowers, affecting 30 million family members.
It's a simple yet powerful idea. Without access to capital, it's difficult to start or grow a business, even the tiniest of mom-and-pop operations. In the absence of alternative banking programs, many people are forced to borrow from loan sharks who charge outrageous interest rates. The poor can get trapped deeper in the pit of poverty. The West African nation of Ghana is home to some of the millions of impoverished people who are trying to turn small change into a better economic future. In Data Yili, another village in the northern part of the country, 70 women are members of microbusiness groups. I'm met by 24 of the women waiting on rough-hewn benches made from teak wood. Before I can ask any questions about their loan circles, they greet me with a traditional welcome song. Some women make food products for local consumption, while others travel the hour's drive to Tamale, the region's commercial center. The Data Yili women all started their businesses with loans and training from the community group Mata and Tadu, which translates as Women of the North. This is their third year in the program. Once one loan is repaid, the group is eligible for another, usually larger, advance. Like business people everywhere, these burgeoning entrepreneurs need access to credit for a number of years. The hope is that they will eventually accumulate enough assets and savings to become self-reliant. Flera Mahama is the president of the village loan circles in Data Yili.
If there wasn't Mata and Tadu, would there be somewhere else you could get loans to start a business?
We had been looking for a long time for money to start our businesses. We couldn't find anything until we met Mata and Tadu. We're happy to work with them, and we all started businesses because of the loans.
Has everyone been able to repay the loans in your group?
We are in our third loan cycle. We can't get a new loan if we haven't paid back the old one, so we always repay. It's a bit tough right now because everything costs more, and people aren't buying as much as they used to. We can still pay back our loans, but we aren't making as much profit as before. But we know that Madame Tadou has to charge interest.
So how have the loans helped you and your family?
Before I met Mara and Tadou, I was in distress. I used to rely on my husband, but there were times he could not provide for me or the children. Today, when my husband doesn't have money, I can help. Now that I am involved in the loan programs, I have seen a change in my family.
Conlan Lembongang is the executive secretary of Matanen Tadou. We talk on the front lawn of the organization's headquarters. Trees full of African birds provide a natural muzak.
The group is self-selecting. For one to belong to a group, the group members would have been satisfied about their ability to be involved in the credit operations. Because they are in the same community and they work together, if you have a business that they suspect will not stand the test of time, then they have a responsibility of advising you and telling you that, well, we can admit you only if you change your business because this business is not viable. And so, and when they are satisfied, then they can guarantee one another. If an individual is not credit worthy, the rest do not agree to guarantee the person. So that's what I mean by they serve as collateral for one another.
What happens if someone doesn't repay?
Oh, the person belongs to a group. If the person doesn't repay, we have no problem. The group has a problem. If the group wants to remain active clients, then they will have to find a way of paying for that person. If they cannot pay for that person, then the group is considered a non-active group. But most often, if one person is unable to pay, the rest are able to come together to pay.
What is the interest rate that the women are charged on their microloans?
The interest rate depends on the costing that we do for a particular year. It's not static. For example, in 2004, the interest rate was 32% per annum.
Say that again, how much?
32% per annum. In 2005, it is 36% per annum. It may go down in subsequent years, especially when we become operationally efficient and we can reduce our cost of operations, and then we can reduce the interest rate. The interest rate for banks is most often higher than the interest rates that we are charging.
That seems quite high of an interest rate.
Yes, if you look at it in terms of the interest rate of the Canadian dollar, which is a single digit, yes, it will seem high. We must be sustainable. We must be able to continue to give the loans. We must be able to at least increase the loan size if they require.
The on-time repayment rate hovers around 92%. It's almost 100% when late payers are included. But if the women didn't have to pay back the interest, or even the loans, they would keep more of their hard-earned money. So why not give grants instead? Sam Daly Harris has a simple answer.
I think the primary answer to the question of why not grants is because you can reach so many more if the loans are repaid. In other words, if I give you $100 and you improve your business, I got to go find the next $100 to give to someone else. If I lend you $100 and it comes back, this is money that's moving and moving over and over through the community, and the potential for expansion is dramatic.
And the people that microcredit practitioners want to reach with all those revolving loans are the so-called poorest of the poor.
100 million children, primary school age, not in school. Who are they? They're the children of the very poor. Some 29,000 children under 5 dying each day from largely preventable things. Who are they? The children of the very poor. The greatest amount of innovation in international development in reaching the very poor is happening in microcredit.
But the poor are not one homogeneous group. Conlan acknowledges that microcredit won't help everyone lift themselves up by their bootstraps. For some people, just getting those metaphorical boots is the struggle.
Do you feel that your programs are reaching the poorest of the poor?
It's a yes and no. I have advocated in the past that for the poorest of the poor, you need grants, at least to be able to provide the basic survival needs before you can go onto loans. And that has not been possible for us to give grants because ourselves, our resources are not enough. But the type of people that we target, actually, they are the enterprising poor. They are not the poorest of the poor because the poorest of the poor cannot have food to eat. Those people, it is important to target them with grants so that they will move from the absolute poverty level to a higher level where they can then join and build themselves up.
Whether called the poorest of the poor, the entrepreneurial poor, or the bankable poor, the majority of people targeted by microcredit programs are women.
How does microcredit help alleviate poverty?
Because we work with women. Women constitute about 51% of the population of this part of the country. But we are in a patriarchal society where women are completely marginalized. Women are considered property of men. And then they have no access to resources. They have no control over even the resources that they have. And so many more women are poorer than men. Their potentials are not developed. So when you begin to provide microfinance services, that builds their capacity, gives them the confidence, then they begin to work, they begin to make profits, they begin to have access to resources, and in the course of that, their poverty levels reduce. And that it also, we also know quite well that women, more than men, are responsible for the upkeep of the families.
Back in Datchayili, a village elder drops a small rock at my feet. Now that we have changed the women, she says, we must change the men, because it takes two fingers to pick up a stone. The men of her community do seem generally supportive of the loan programs. One of them is Mustafa Isahuk, a hard-working farmer of maize, millet, and rice.
I have 3 wives and 11 children, and I have to provide for all of them, and it isn't easy. I used to have a lot of quarrels in my compound. They'd argue with me and they'd argue with each other when times were tough. But all of the women are getting loans, and now the quarreling has almost stopped.
I just have one wife and one child, and there's quarrels, so I can't imagine 3 wives and 11 children.
Mora Alassa, the chief of the village, also supports the loan initiative, but with a few reservations.
The support that the women are getting is enough to help reduce suffering in the village. The children are going to school and improving their lives. That helps the whole community. The men also benefit because they get their money from time to time. And when the men can't earn enough, the women are helping out.
There's a Women of the North Association. Does there need to be a Men of the North loan program?
It's
good for the women, but if a man wants to join, he looks like he's trying to take over and disturb them. I wish there was an organization for the men too, so we could get the same help in the same way. Otherwise, you have to go to your wife every day saying, give me this, give me that. But you'll only get money sometimes.
The head of Women of the North says the organization tries to get the men of the North walking in the same direction.
How are the men responding to these microcredit programs for women?
Initially, it amounted to removing a tooth in somebody's mouth, a raw tooth. But the strategy that we did from the beginning is when you enter into a community, you are entering to target the women, but you target the men as well in your sensitization. And so initially they were very resistant, but with sensitization, they are actually now on board.
Conlan admits that sometimes men can have considerable influence on the women's loan programs.
Well, some of them still capitalize on the fact that the women are illiterate, as they try to organize them and then try to use them and still take control of their resources. So much as we appreciate their effort, we try to make sure that there's a barrier. They don't get near the resources so that they will still take control of the resources. And we do regular monitoring to ensure that women actually have access and control over the resources.
This is the Association of Northern Women. It works for women. Its membership is mostly women. And the head of it is a man.
Definitely. I was expecting that question even before we started. That is the problem that we are trying to resolve. The population of literate women in northern part of Ghana is only about 20%. And it took us 2 years advertising for a woman who had the skills and the experience to be able to drive this organization. Incidentally, I happened to be part of the project as a project accountant. I had all the organizational memory, and I had the qualification it takes. I was gender sensitive. So the board of directors felt that, well, rather than wait forever and ever, why not appoint this man in an acting position to hold the fort? And the beneficiaries at the General Assembly decided that they didn't need a woman if this man was doing exactly what the woman would have come to do. And so I came to stay.
And the General Assembly is made up of mostly women?
All women. It's made up of representatives of the various groups.
So you have 7,000 women watching your every move.
Yes, indeed.
But because of the focus on women, do microcredit programs just add to an already heavy burden? Sherry Fiakoyo and the other women in Sanergo Village say they do, although you won't hear them complaining.
With the work you have to do with the family, does having the business make the days longer and the work harder?
It's worth it because of the money and the satisfaction that we get out of it. It's our own business, even though it takes up time.
What about you? Does it add burden? Does it make it very long days?
A lot of the businesses, like making rice, can be done right in the compound alongside other chores. So we can do the work on both at the same time. It's not too much of a burden.
When do they wake up and when do they go to sleep?
We wake up at 4 a.m. and then at night we go to bed between 8 and 10. It's a long day, but it's okay because the loans help us so much.
The same question is asked about the men.
The men also wake up at 4, but they are waking up for the early prayers. After prayers, they go out into the farms to work. Then they come home in the afternoon to take their lunch.
The women involved in lending circles in northern Ghana do appear confident and ready to assert themselves. They have gained respect in the household and the village because they are bringing in money through their own efforts. The microloan method strengthens dignity and independence in a way a handout cannot. And that is one of the main non-monetary benefits of microcredit. When I ask one husband if the new business ventures are good for his family, he says that while they help feed the kids and pay for school, the men have never received a single penny. He also thinks the husband should have more say in how the profit is spent. The women don't agree. There's no arguing about the growing popularity of microcredit. In 1997, an estimated 13 million people were being reached through peer lending. Today, over 100 million people are involved. Many development NGOs and foreign aid agencies support microcredit programs. Sam Daly Harris is a walking encyclopedia of microcredit. He names who is bankrolling the various programs around the world.
For example, Canadian CEDA, Swedish CEDA, USAID, The donors' agencies probably seeded much of it in the 80s and even to the 90s and even now. Individual donors, people who contribute to groups like Opportunity International or other groups like Finken Acción and Grameen Foundation, etc. Donors, people who might give $100 or $1,000 or $10,000 as their charity, you might say, but it's more than that. The investors are getting in, the domestic banks, the social investors, the Oiko Credits, Van City and British Columbia. So the funds are coming from social investment where they're getting a 2 or 3% return, and then from basic investors who are getting a 5 and 6 and 7 and 8% return.
With all this new interest and businesses and banks and governments and so many people starting to really get excited about it, you're not worried that it's going to become more about recoupment of investment than the development tool?
Yes. I'm worried about if it becomes more and more commercialized, that it could move away from the very poor because the regulation, the central bank, requires more rigorous reporting. So I got to stop doing $50 loans and move to $1,500 loans. I'm worried about investors who want a 10%, 11% return on their investment in euros or dollars, you know, on the back of who? On the back of poor women around the world. It's not about what my bank's repayment rate is. It's not about how many millions of dollars we lent last year. It's about change in people's lives and people taking control over their lives. It's about enhancing dignity and self-esteem.
Some people would say that microcredit suits our needs because it's based on a repayment, recoupment model. We're kind of foisting this idea because it works for us. It's a donor-driven kind of ideology. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think on the contrary, it's actually developing world-driven, local leader-driven. This is not donor-driven. It's driven by Ilabat Itseva in India. It's not donor-driven. It's driven by Muhammad Yunus at Grameen Bank. Oh, yes, the donors, you know, they do all this stuff. But if you want to see where the brilliance is, if you want to see where the innovation is, if you want to see where the inspiration is, it's not the piece that's donor-driven.
Could this new popularity of microcredit divert funds and attention from other programs, be it health, education?
No. Now, of course, it could, but I have to say no. What I mean is, number one, the percent of World Bank spending every year on microfinance is less than 1%. I think if you looked at CEDA and USAID and British DFID, it would be in the 1, 2, 3% range. Number two, where the mass of funding will come in the future isn't from the CEDAs and USAIDs or World Banks of the world. It's going to be coming from the domestic banks. It's going to be coming from domestic savings. And it, to some extent, will be coming from global banks and other investors.
Yet a lack of credit is not the only cause of hardship in the third world. Many factors contribute to underdevelopment, including illiteracy and lack of education, low prices for export crops, barriers to first world markets, poor wages, crippling debt, lack of infrastructure, corruption, and the legacy of colonialism. Microcredit is not a panacea to poverty.
It's not a panacea, but I would argue not a panacea, but the most powerful intervention that we know of. There was a 14-year study, World Bank study, the most rigorous so far, that said 40% of the reduction of moderate poverty in Bangladesh was because of microcredit. A study said 3% of clients leave extreme poverty every year because of microcredit. There was a human development report from UNDP in 2005 that said, while India is leader in globalization in the neighborhood, its neighbor, Bangladesh, is doing much better in human development. For example, if the percentage decline in child mortality in India had matched that of Bangladesh over the last 10 years, 732,000 fewer children would have died this year in India. The country that Henry Kissinger called the world's basket case in 1976 is one of the few countries on target to reach the Millennium Development Goals. And I would argue, not only, but I would argue largely because of the power and the impact and the spread of microcredit in that country.
Microcredit, however, can't deal with the bigger macro issues of a country's debt load or a country's lack of money for education.
What are the next things that parents do with the profits from their micro businesses is to send their children to school?
You could say, you know, microcredit gives them the money to send them to school, but if the schools aren't there.
Well, but yes, but oftentimes, you know, they will then create schools in lieu of government schools that work.
Mata Entadu's executive secretary agrees that microcredit is only one piece of the poverty alleviation puzzle.
Microcredit can go a long way to address poverty, but it has to be in conjunction with other interventions. One of the issues of poverty is illiteracy. I think that the government has a role to play in terms of ensuring that there's free and compulsory education. The government has a role to play in sensitizing our cultural endemic areas where a woman is considered property. Otherwise, you will help this woman today to get out of poverty and there's another woman tomorrow. I mean, there's a number of activities that we can do to be able to actually solve the problem of poverty completely, not microfinance alone.
There are many other practical ideas that could contribute to change. For example, most of the microcredit women in northern Ghana earmark their earnings for school fees and uniforms. Lower-cost education is one obvious way to help families. Flira Mahama of the Dato Yili Loan Groups offers her wish list.
The women who make shea butter or husk rice have to transport it all the way to Tamale to have it milled, and that's far away. We have to arrange a truck to take us, and that costs money. But if we had a mill that we could walk to, our profits would go up. And what would also help my family and other families in the village is water. We don't have clean water. The women have to spend many hours looking for water and walking far, and that is time we can't spend on our businesses. And electricity. If we had light, the children could study at night and do better at school. And I wouldn't have to spend money buying kerosene for light.
The loans have helped with the startup costs of many micro enterprises in northern Ghana, and the women have earned some much needed cash. Yet microcredit can only take the poor so far down the path of development. And there are definitely bumps along the way. Tampai is a typical rural village of traditional compounds, each a family of round huts topped with thatch roofs surrounding a common courtyard. A group of women here have received 10 loans over 10 years from Matan Entadu. Through investment and very hard work, they have built up an extensive shea nut butter business. Shea fruit and the nut inside are indigenous to West Africa. An edible butter can be processed from the pod, which looks a bit like a large hazelnut. Shea oil is an ingredient in many Ghanaian soups and stews, and is also sold in the developed world as a premium moisturizer. The women walk me through the labor-intensive process. They first buy or pick the raw shea fruit, which grows on trees shaped like tall green mushrooms sprouting on the flat African grasslands. The fruit is boiled to separate the flesh from the nuts, which are in turn parboiled and dried. The shells are cracked open and the hard white kernels crushed with long sticks. The shea nut pieces are roasted in huge cast iron pots over charcoal fires and taken to a mill for grinding. This shea nut mash is then kneaded by hand for up to an hour as water is added to separate the oil. A thick paste is skimmed off the top, and this butter is heated in kettles at high heat to release the shea oil. The women of this village throw in a bit of ground-up tree bark to give their butter the color of tarnished gold. The early successes of the shea butter entrepreneurs have improved the living conditions of the women and the entire village. But they are now experiencing the ups and downs of selling on the open market. Amina Idrasu is one of the shea butter producers. She's been in this business for a long time and explains what's now happening.
We used to take the shea butter to the market and sell it with no problems. There were always lots of customers. But now, the market is not good. After all the work making it, the butter might sit in the market for days because not enough people are buying it. Sometimes we bring some home for our own meals, but sometimes we have no choice but to sell it to a middleman for very little money. We carry the oil until it melts all over our bodies, but people aren't buying it as often from us because the middleman can sell it cheaper. But we can't sell it as cheap as them, or we won't make any money at all. So the middlemen wait until we are desperate, until we have been in the stall for days, and then buy it. They know we can't take it all back home. And because these middlemen are buying it in bulk, they can then go sell it to the exporters. Someone is making a lot of profit, but it isn't us. But what can we do?
Why not stop the shea butter business and try something else?
We have no business other than shea butter. We have been in this business a long time. We have grown up in it. Why should we have to learn to do something else?
Shea butter production has become part of their village culture. Are the women riding out market fluctuations, or are they clinging to an extended family business that is no longer profitable? Could the women lack the entrepreneurial mindset that is necessary to survive in the sometimes harsh world of modern economics?
You take out loans and you spend a lot of time making a product that you don't get a lot of money for. Is it worth it?
When we started, it was better. We were able to sell our butter and make money. We even got more from the middlemen then because the economy was better and we got higher prices. But the economy seems to be slowing down and everything costs more. People aren't buying as much shea butter, or they are buying cheaper imported cooking oils.
What needs to happen now to improve your situation?
We need marketing and distribution help, some agency that can buy directly from the women and come right here to our village to get our shea butter. Then we wouldn't have to pay all those costs of transport to the market.
Has it been difficult to pay back the loans?
We used to be able to pay off the loans when we had better prices. The interest wasn't a big problem, but now we don't make as much profit and it's harder to pay back the loans.
What if these villagers hadn't gotten involved in the loan program 10 years ago and weren't now so dependent on shea butter? Would the community be less vulnerable and better off in the long run? The women gathered in Tampai don't think so.
There's definitely been an improvement in our living standards. If the loan program had not come into our lives, we would have been more destitute. In the past, we have enjoyed working on the business. But in the last year, we have not been able to pay back our loans on time.
We've been worried that Mata and Tudu would be angry with us, but they have been understanding and have not put pressure on us. If we had gotten loans from anywhere else, our business would be in trouble, and we would be in trouble.
Down the road from the village in out of earshot, Two staff from Matanen Todu tell me more about the situation. Asia Amama is a loans officer for the organization. She admits it's not easy to collect on the loans.
So when I come to collect the loan, and they explain, no market this week, so we don't have anything to give you. I know their problem because I'm also a woman. So I always leave them and go back to the office to inform my director what is going on in the community. When I come to explain, he also understands me because he knows the situation of the communities. We don't disturb them. We don't come to disturb them about the loan. Anytime they are ready, they can come to pay.
But if many groups aren't able to pay their loans, that puts your organization at some risk, does it not?
Yes, we are worried, but what can we do? We just have to be patient. It's not all the communities who are having this situation. All the group will come out to pay their loan, okay. But the problem with the women is those in shea butter processing. Anytime I go there, I think they always have a problem. They always have an excuse to give me because of not paying their loan. And I also understand because I know the situation in the market.
If the other groups are able to pay their loans a bit better than these women because of their situation, would it not be responsible for your organization to encourage them to move into another business?
Even if you tell them, the business of shea butter is very low, can you change into a different business? They may not accept because they are used to, even though the market is very low.
But what if it traps them in a cycle of poverty?
Well, even if the market is very poor to them, they appreciate what Matan Todu have done for them. They have benefited a lot from Matan Todu because they started with Matan Todu almost 10 years. They have no any income apart from the loan.
Kwame Jerfortuk works as a project officer with Matanen Todu. He's been posted there by CUSO, a Canadian nonprofit organization that has partnered with both Amasashina and Women of the North. While most of CUSO's volunteer cooperants come from Canada, Kwame is a Ghanaian in-country development worker.
Do you worry that the microcredit program could be making some women's groups very dependent on a vulnerable business?
I think that the women have been quite versatile. I see some of the groups changing into other businesses when they realize that they are not doing well. But we also have communities that are noted for certain productions. And this community we just visited is noted for their shea butter processing. And this is because if you just look across, you find out that most of the trees around are shea trees. And that is why, even though we see the risk, and that is not good for microfinance, but we should also remember that the organization was set up with a development motive. If we talk of business, saying that let's recover every loan, then what happens to our development eye?
Does Matan Todu have the resources to help these women with the marketing?
No, we don't have the resources. And Matan Todu, from the onset of the organization, the issue was to empower them economically and thought that the loan scheme was enough. But the realization is that, yes, the women have been empowered. They have gone into economic activities. But now the constraint is the market. And I think that Matan Todu hasn't got the resources to be able to carry out a marketing program for the members. However, what Matan Todu should be thinking of is how to partner with some organizations that are into marketing. Maybe at this point we need to look beyond microcredit, because you're empowering people. These are people who are into businesses, and if they don't have accessible market, fair prices, then you can imagine that at the end of the day, the microfinance industry is going to be constrained.
Shea butter is known for its wrinkle-reducing properties, and international businesses such as The Body Shop are looking to buy it for their products. But fulfilling these orders is beyond the reach of the women involved in the microloan programs in northern Ghana. Back at Matanen Todu, Conlan Lambangang also recognizes that shea butter highlights the potential and the problems in microcredit.
Unfortunately for us, those companies come in and they are requesting for continuous supply, certain amount of quantity, certain amount of quality, and our women are not able to provide that quantity, that quality, and that regular supply. So they miss out on the larger markets.
Why aren't they able to produce the quantity and quality?
To produce quantity, you need machinery. You need machines to be able to crush the shea nuts in quantities. You need to be able to retrieve the butter through a mechanical form, but they have no access to this machinery. Women are unable to produce shea butter throughout the year because they are also farmhands on their husband's farms. And so the shea butter becomes a part-time job because their husbands may not permit them to do full-time shea butter production throughout the year. For the quality, different women have different approaches to producing butter, and it must be uniform. They do not have the quality measures. So it is all about capacity, all about the skills to be able to do that.
So can your organization provide those skills or give bigger loans to get the machinery that's needed to tap into this market?
Our strategy now is to get microcredit loans to as many people as possible. To talk about machinery will be huge sums of money.
Your organization has been able to help women get up to a level where a large company like The Body Shop wants to buy their product. Yeah. But taking that next step is difficult and maybe beyond the mandate of your organization. But that next step could raise the standard of living of a lot of people as well.
Yeah, definitely. That is true. What can we do differently to ensure that the loans that we provide to these women, they are able to use it and then they can get a better return? And the better return is where we they produce and they can only sell to domestic consumers without being able to sell to commercial consumers who would be willing and able to pay good price. So that is the challenge. And so for now, we do not have the resources. We do not have the ability to be able to get them to that level.
How will that next step be taken?
We are beginning to collaborate. We are beginning to talk to other people to find out whether there are different ways we can work together to solve this problem.
So is microcredit the best approach for ending extreme poverty? Would the resources devoted to it be better spent in other ways? Perhaps, but while we muster the political will to act, the world's poor can't wait.
Could you say that it's just as important to try to get the world's poor to have title to their land, to have some collateral?
The answer is yes, but it's kind of like, you know, wouldn't it be better if there was very decent wage employment? Yes, but while we're waiting for land title, while we're waiting for very decent wage employment, here we are. And so the answer is yes. And in fact, one of the other things that micro borrowers do with the proceeds from their businesses is buy land.
You're not looking for perfection, you're looking for results.
Well, these other solutions are fine. It's just that they're not expanding rapidly enough. They're not reaching this village and that country and in that province.
What's your name, ma'am?
Adamu Mohammed.
I'm not Mutafa.
Zira Alasa.
Yeah, you can.
You can.
Belema Pusini.
Microcredit emerged from the belief that the poor are not poor in all facets of their lives. And they have unique survival skills that can serve them well in the realm of business. And neither are they faceless statistics. They're real people with real hopes, fears, struggles, and successes. Providing business loans may or may not be the best way to lift them out of poverty. But the appeal of microcredit is that it offers women increased independence today, not tomorrow. It helps get kids to school today, not tomorrow. It bankrolls community development today, not tomorrow. And when tomorrow does come and the loans are repaid, that many more people will get credit where credit is due. For your community radio station, I'm Sean Kelly in Tamale, Ghana. Where Credit is Due is a production of CUSO with the support of the Government of Canada through the Canadian International Development Agency. For more information on CUSO or microcredit, please visit www.cuso.org. Yes.